Questions? Yes. Say again?
Can I borrow a calculator?
Today's not a quiz day. No.
Wednesday.
Wednesday. Not for a while. Not for a while. Other questions? So, we're starting to deal with temperature as a concept, and we haven't really very carefully defined temperature because it turns out to be pretty difficult to define. But we'll discover today that, roughly speaking, temperature is a measurement of kind of the kinetic energy per particle. But we have lots of ways of measuring temperature. Basically, all the formulas would be happiest if we used absolute degrees, Kelvin. And in particular, that's what we need for the ideal gas equation. But no one in the world actually measures temperature commonly with degrees Kelvin. So if you're in the United States, people use Fahrenheit degrees in order to measure temperature, which is a system where the freezing point of water is about 32 and the boiling point of water is about 212. Every place else in the world uses Celsius degrees, where the zero is the, approximately speaking, the zero is the freezing point of water and 100 is the boiling point of water. And neither of these two zeros corresponds to absolute zero. So when we're using Celsius or Fahrenheit, it's kind of funny. We're not measuring from zero. We're measuring from some arbitrary other setup point. If we actually want to get Kelvin degrees, then we want to add the lowest possible temperature so that we're measuring from zero, lowest possible temperature, 0 degrees Kelvin, or minus 273.15 degrees Celsius is so-called absolute zero. So I think temperature conversion is pretty easy. This is the way I do it, at least, with this equation, which I would rearrange according to whether I want to get degrees Fahrenheit or degrees Celsius. The book has separate equations for converting Fahrenheit to Celsius and Celsius to Fahrenheit. It all amounts to the same thing. There is an absolute temperature system where Fahrenheit, the size of the Fahrenheit degree is used, but called the Rankine scale, but it doesn't really have any relevance, certainly to us. If we heat things up, they expand. The volume would expand, say mercury that's in a mercury thermometer. The change in volume depends on this parameter, the volume expansion coefficient, and the amount of temperature. Things like beta and alpha and densities and Young's modulus, those are different for different materials, and you typically find them tabulated in something like the CRC. Their values are not particularly memorable. These things are approximately constant, just like all those other things I mentioned, but if you vary the temperature enough, expansion coefficients will vary a little bit. So we have linear expansion and volume expansion. The book has area expansion, which I don't have a lot of interest in. Didn't make it to this review board. One of the problems that people have with temperature that's a little bit tricky is what happens if we wanted to convert one of these alphas, and the units of that alpha, for example, it might be, I don't know, 10 to the minus 6 per degree Celsius. What if we wanted to convert that to degrees Fahrenheit? And what's tricky is that the 0 point offset doesn't matter, it's just the size of the degree, right? So a change in temperature of 1 degree Kelvin is the same as a change in temperature of 1 degree Celsius, but a change in temperature of 1 degrees Kelvin corresponds to a larger change, 9/5 of a degree in Fahrenheit. So if we wanted to convert this to degrees Fahrenheit, we would say that one change in degree of 1 degree of Celsius would correspond to 9/5 of a degree Fahrenheit. Okay? So we don't care about the 0 point difference when we're talking about the size of the degrees. And we've got the ideal gas law, which If chemistry were doing what the MCAT people say they're going to do, that you would have seen ideal gas law already. But apparently for lots of you, it's new. It's a pretty simple equation that relates the pressure. So it's not a density, that's a pressure, and the volume and the number of moles, and a universal constant called the gas constant, whose value I would probably give you on an exam, but it's worth writing on your cheat sheet, and the absolute temperature. If we have a constant number of moles, which you often do in these sorts of problems, then you can just rearrange that into this is that sort of equation, the way we've had for the Bernoulli equation and the continuity equation, that P1V1 over T1 is P2V2 over T2. Questions? If you wanted to include the, and I saw that some of these problems have different numbers of molecules, right? If you have different numbers of moles, then you could put that in too. Questions? Okay, how about some iQuiz questions? I don't think we did these ones last time. So if we double the temperature of an ideal gas, it goes from 30 degrees Celsius to 60 degrees Celsius, and the volume is kept constant, how does the pressure change in the gas? So far, I'm fooling, I think, everybody. But the vast majority aren't voting. I think, one correct answer. So the most common, first of all, I hope you know if you increase the temperature, generally speaking, the pressure is going to increase. So B and D look, so I guess A is the one that's out because it would say that the pressure would decrease. If the temperature really did double, the pressure really should double. But the temperature really didn't double, right? It did in degrees Celsius. But I hope it's clear if I increase the temperature from 1 degree Celsius to 2 degrees Celsius, the pressure would change hardly at all, right? What matters is the absolute temperature. So the absolute temperature has gone from 303 to 333. So the temperature has actually increased only by about 10%. So the pressure is only going to increase by about 10%. So the pressure increases, but by considerably less than double. If the temperature really had doubled, in absolute sense, then the pressure would have doubled. So we've got two identical rooms, same volume. Temperatures are maintained at different values. Which room has more air? You're unhappy with that answer. Sarah was unhappy with that answer too. So in some sense, if you wanted to, I guess you could say they have the same amount of air. They have the same number of cubic meters of air, but the density of cold air is more than the density of hot air. So the same number of cubic meters at lower temperature is going to correspond to more moles, more grams, in any normal sense, more air.
You said the density of cold air is
Say again?
The density of holes are more than the density of water?
Yes. So why is that? If we heat air, it's going to expand, right? So the same mass is going to be in more volume, and so it's going to have a lower density. So cold air is going to sink, and hot air is going to rise in a room. So an interesting kind of tricky question, maybe it's too tricky for this sort of IQuiz sort of situation. If we compare moist air and dry air, which has the higher density? Same temperature, compare moist air and dry air, which has a higher density? So Avogadro's hypothesis, right, is that we have the same number of molecules, but of course water, H2O, has a molecular mass of 18, whereas the air in this room is mostly nitrogen. There's a little bit of oxygen, so nitrogen is N2, so we're talking 28 or 32, roughly speaking 30 for the gram molecular weight of air. So we're going to have the same number of molecules, but they're more massive molecules if we're talking about air. So it's going to be higher density than moist air. Seems exactly backwards. Say again? Ah, so you're saying, is moist air like air except more water? And the answer is no, because the pressure has to be the same. So if we have moist air, it's at the same pressure, and it's going to have the same number of molecules per unit volume, but those molecules are going to weigh less on average if some of them are water as opposed to nitrogen or oxygen. Okay, so helium, for example, clearly has a lower density than air. That's why balloons float. And water is just the same sort of story, except not so dramatic. Right? Helium has a molecular mass that's roughly a tenth of that of air, whereas water, it's more like half of air. More questions? So, I don't know, we can demonstrate a lot of these things. Here's, probably can't read this, this is a little meter. And up close, you can see that it's reading zero at atmospheric pressure, because this is a gauge pressure meter. So it goes to negative pressure, so we'd need to add in atmospheric pressure. And it has kind of funny units. It's not pounds per square inch, it's not pascals, it's actually newtons per square centimeter. So. And if I close the valve and I compress this fluid, I don't know, some of you can see that if I compress it enough, that the needle goes up. Okay, come on, needle, go up. It's gone up. I just can't see it from my perspective. I can feel it twisting this thing, that it's getting noticeably hard to twist. Okay, so smaller volume, more pressure. The size of a balloon is determined by the difference between the inside and the outside pressure. Right? There's an elastic filament that's acting just like surface tension that is putting the air inside at a slightly higher pressure than the outside. If we take the air out of this container, see, I think that the balloon has gotten bigger. Bigger. Everyone believe that, even in the back? We can take out more air. It's huge. It's hard to get the air out. So, I mean, gas really does have, a corresponding pressure. And we don't notice air because it's at a relatively low density, right? It has a density that's about 1.3 kilograms per cubic meter, whereas water has a density that's 1,000 times more. If we have a gas that has more molecular mass, there's going to be a larger density and you're going to have a more noticeable effect. So what we've got here is mercury and we've got little bits of glass. And as that mercury starts to create a noticeable amount of vapor, you can start to see that those glass pieces are being pushed around by that vapor pretty dramatically. So, I mean, it took some while for people to realize that gas was really there, that air was really there, but it is there, it just has a relatively low density. If you're going to go to Venus, incidentally, where the pressure is about 100 times what it is on the surface of the Earth, there the density of the air is about a tenth the density of water, so it's quite noticeable effect on objects. Questions? Well, what we'd like to do is to get some sort of handle on what is temperature. And the direction we're going to take usually goes under the name of kinetic theory or kinetic molecular theory. And it may seem funny, but really up until about 1900, people were not sure that molecules existed. The idea of atoms goes back to the Greeks. The word goes back to the Greeks. But you can explain things pretty well if you think that matter is absolutely uniform, that there isn't a small enough piece. And kinetic theory was kind of the first beginning of demonstrations that that stuff really was made out of material. And it came up with an explanation of how gas works. So we've been focusing on the gas pushing on the walls, but Newton's third law says the opposite is also the case. That is to say, the walls have to be pushing on the gas, and there has to be some corresponding effect. So if we think about a very simple situation, so let's imagine a cube that's got just one molecule in it that's moving around. We have a force and a pressure that's acting on this side. So the force that's acting on it, we think about the gas pushing this side out, but of course this force has to be acting on that molecule. That force has to be the pressure times the area. Now remember that the impulse that's the force times the time. So that's going to be the pressure times the area times the time. That has to be the change in the momentum. And if we think about this molecule careening around, every time it has a collision with this wall, its velocity in the x direction is going to change, right? It's going to be going from moving in the positive x direction to the negative x direction. So the change in momentum, remember P is for momentum, is going to be twice the mass of that object times its velocity in the x direction. And the time between these collisions we can calculate because the molecule has to go to this wall and back. So the time is twice the size of this box, the distance, divided by the velocity in the x direction. So if we plug this in, this is going to be the time between collisions, and this is the change in momentum that impulse is occurring. We have that the pressure times the area times 2 times the distance divided by the velocity in the x direction has to be 2 times the mass, times the velocity in the x direction. And notice that the 2's go away. And this cross-sectional area times that distance is the volume. So what I've got then is the pressure times the volume is the mass times the velocity in the x direction squared. Now, if I have lots of molecules, this is just going to happen for all of them. So if I, instead of having one molecule, I have n molecules, then the pressure times the volume is going to be n times the velocity in the x direction. Yes? Yeah, so we don't have any rows. All of the things that look like P's are P's.
But is it the P for pressure
or
the P for momentum?
Ah, thank you. Yes, this is the only P that's momentum. Yeah. Every other P now and in the future is going to be pressure.
So PV is pressure times volume, right?
Yes. So pressure times volume. And we know from the ideal gas law that the pressure times volume is the number of moles times the gas constant times the temperature. And this quantity here kind of looks a little bit like the kinetic energy, right? This is twice the kinetic energy in the x direction. Right, the full kinetic energy would be 1/2 the mass times the velocity in the x direction squared plus the velocity in the y direction squared plus the velocity in the z direction squared. And we only have this term. So what this is going to be then is 2/3 of the total kinetic energy. So we've got the number of moles times R times T is the total, is 2/3 the total kinetic energy. And that's really the main relationship we're after, but let's go one step further. The number of moles, that's the number of particles divided by Avogadro's number. And if I define the gas constant divided by Avogadro's number, those are just constants that you can look up in books. Let me call that KB and name it after a famous dead physicist. So this is called Boltzmann's constant. Then I have that KB times T is 2/3 the total kinetic energy divided by the number of particles. Yes?
Could you just go through that one more time? I am not. Where'd you get the R and the KB? Basically, both the constant.
Yeah, so let's back up. So we got to this point here.
Yep.
So that the pressure times the volume was the number of molecules times what kind of looks a little bit like the kinetic energy in the x direction. It's missing a 2, and we only have the x direction, so it's actually only 2/3 of the kinetic energy in the x direction. The ideal gas law tells us that that same quantity is nRT. So if we kind of put those pieces together, we have nRT, which of course is equal to PV, is 2/3 the total kinetic energy. Now, what is n? N is the number of moles. And the number of moles is the total number of particles divided by Avogadro's number. So this n naught is Avogadro's number, 6 times 10 to the 23rd. So what I've got then is R over n naught. I'm going to call that KB. That's that. Times temperature is equal to the 2/3 of the total kinetic energy divided by the number of particles.
So where did where did moles go?
So the number of moles is equal to n over n naught.
Yep.
Right. So what I have then is n over n naught times RT is 2/3 the kinetic energy. And I'm calling this thing K. And then I'm just bringing the n down.
All right.
Yeah. We're good? So this is 2/3 the kinetic energy per particle. So remember, we have extensive quantities where more is more, and we have intensive quantities where more is the same, right? So density, for example, is an intensive quantity. Whether you have a kilogram of iron or a whole ship full of iron, it all has the same density. But obviously, it has more weight, more volume. So temperature is an intensive quantity, and we see it's an intensive quantity because it's the ratio of two extensive quantities. Just like density is mass, which is extensive, over volume, which is extensive, so the size cancels out. If we have more molecules, we'd have more kinetic energy. The kinetic energy per particle is an intensive quantity that corresponds to temperature. Okay. Incidentally, it's the same equation, but I'm a little bit happier writing this as 3/2 times the Boltzmann constant times the temperature is the kinetic energy per particle. Turns out there's a theorem that's not exactly true, which theorems have problems being that way, but it's often true that for every quadratic degree of freedom and for kinetic energy, it's written as the sum of 3 squares. For every quadratic degree of freedom, there's 1/2 kT worth of energy. So we have 3 quadratic degrees of freedom, so we're going to end up with 3/2 kT energy per particle. Okay. So temperature is related to the kinetic energy per particle, how fast particles are moving. Question? So how fast are particles moving? Well, if we want the speed, so we have that 3/2 times the Boltzmann constant times temperature is the kinetic energy of a particle, right? 1/2 mv². So if we want the typical speed of a particle, we're going to have 3 Boltzmann constant T divided by m is v². So a typical velocity of a molecule is given by that. And if we plug numbers in for air, for example, we get something like 300 meters a second. Roughly speaking, the speed of sound. But not all molecules are moving at exactly the same speed, right? There's a distribution, a so-called bell-shaped curve. So if we make a graph kind of the number of molecules with a particular speed versus the speed, it's kind of a bell-shaped curve like that. And the famous dead physicist who did this first was Maxwell. And Boltzmann also played a role later on, so sometimes this is called the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. So some molecules are moving noticeably faster than this speed, and some of them are moving slower. So what are we going to take as our typical speed? So using typical values, I don't know, you might use the peak value, the mode value, the most common speed that the molecules have. Maybe a more obvious thing would be the average speed. which turns out to be a little bit faster. This quantity here, if you think about what we did, this was the average of the square. So this was the square root of the average of the square of the velocity. And things like this are called RMS, root mean square. And the root mean square velocity is a little bit faster than the average, and the average velocity is a little bit faster than the mode velocity, the most common velocity. But they're all within, I think, 10% of each other, so it's not a tremendous difference. And this one is the easiest one to calculate. So usually when we're talking about speeds, we're talking about RMS speeds of molecules. You can see that at the same temperature, lower mass molecules are going to be moving faster. So helium molecules, helium atoms, are going to be moving a lot faster than the oxygen molecules in this room. You might wonder why there isn't lots of helium and hydrogen around, right? Turns out that more than 90% of the mass of the universe is in hydrogen and helium. Presumably the Earth was formed with lots of hydrogen and helium. But you also know that if you throw something up fast enough, it doesn't come down, right? The escape velocity. So the escape velocity for hydrogen and helium the typical velocity of hydrogen and helium molecules is comparable to the escape velocity. So it turns out that those that are on the tail end will actually escape from the Earth. And if you wait long enough, everyone's on the tail eventually. So we lose hydrogen, we leak out hydrogen and helium all the time. Planets with a higher escape velocity, like Jupiter or the Sun, they're able to retain the hydrogen and helium. So Jupiter, Saturn, the Sun, all those things are 90+ percent. Well, actually 98% hydrogen and helium combined. Okay. So let's take a break and take a look at some of the homework questions. Where did I put my homework questions? It's big, so I didn't see it. So we've got more ideal gas law problems in this section. It's kind of an important equation, so we're going to hit it twice. So here we have kind of a complicated story. So we have an automobile tire that's inflated with air that's at 10 degrees Celsius. And during that process, the air is compressed to 28% of its original volume, and its temperature is increased to 40 degrees Celsius. We'll learn, in a couple of weeks, that it's a natural result of compressing something typically is to heat it up. So we're supposed to figure out what the pressure of the tire is after all of this goes through. Okay, so this is a nice proportion problem. So we've got that P2 is the original pressure, the ratio of the volumes, and the ratio of the temperatures. And we're told that the final volume is just 28%, 0.28, times the original volume. And the original temperature was 273 plus 10. And the final temperature was 273 plus 40. And the original pressure was atmospheric pressure, 1.01 times 10 to the fifth. So if we just plug and chug, we've got 1.01 times 10 to the fifth, V1 over 0.28 V1. Well, the V1s are going to cancel out. And then we've got 283 divided by 313. So 1.01, enter exponent 5, and we've got to divide that by 0.28, and then we've got 313 and 283 divided times. So what I get is basically, I don't know if I believe that. Yeah, I must have made an exponent error. So 4 times 10 to the 5th pascals. So after that, the car dries for a while, and the air gets almost to the boiling point of water, and things expand when they're hot. Not a whole lot for rubber, but it expands by 2%. What's the pressure now? So we've got P3, the new pressure, is equal to P2, V2 over V3, and then T3 over T2. So we've got this basically 4 times 10 to the 5th pascals. The final volume is 1.02 times the version 2 of the volume. And the temperature is now 273 plus 85, whereas the temperature before was this 313. So 102 divided by 273, 85 added to that. And I get 4.47 times 10 to the 5th pascals.
Why is it 102?
Because it increased by 2%. So it's all that it was before plus 2% more. Okay, so the P1V1 over T1 version is often a useful formula. So gas is contained in a 8-liter vessel, and we're probably going to want to convert that to cubic meters. There are 1,000 liters in a cubic meter. We're told what the temperature and the pressure is, and again, unless they say gauge pressure, we're going to assume that this is the absolute pressure. We're supposed to determine the number of moles and how many molecules are in the gas. Okay, so PV is equal to nRT. So the number of moles is going to be the pressure times the volume divided by RT. And the pressure is 9 atmospheres. So that's 9 times 1.01 times 10 to the 5th pascals. There are 1,000 cubic liter. There are 1,000 liters in a cubic meter. So this is 0.008 meters cubed. R is still 8.31. And the temperature is 20 added on to 273 or 293. So we've got 9.09 enter exponent 5, and 0.008, and 8.31 divided by it, and 293 divided by that. And what we get is basically 3 moles. And if you know how many moles, it's trivial to figure out how many molecules, right? Because there are 6.02 times 10 to the 23rd, that's Avogadro's number, items in a mole. What's the average kinetic energy of a molecule of oxygen at a temperature of 300K. So we had that the average kinetic energy was 3/2 times the Boltzmann constant times T. And the Boltzmann constant you can look up, or you can remember that the Boltzmann constant is the gas constant divided by Avogadro's number. Let's do it the latter way. So gas constant is 3.13. 6.02 times 10 to the 23rd is the number of molecules. The temperature is 300K. And we've got 3/2. So, of course, we're going to get a very small kinetic energy of a molecule of oxygen. And notice that the oxygen didn't matter at all, right? Same amount of kinetic energy in any old molecule that we'd be talking about. And we get an incredibly tiny kinetic energy, 6.21 times 10 to the 21 joules. Use Avogadro's number to figure out the mass of a helium atom. Well, we know that a helium that there are 4 grams per mole . So the mass of a helium atom in kilograms is going to be the 4 grams divided by the 6.02 times 10 to the 23rd particles. So the grams per mole is kind of the one non-MKS thing we have. So the gram molecular weight of helium is 4 grams as opposed to being 4 kilograms. So we could change the definition of Avogadro's number by increasing it by a factor of 1,000, but instead we just have to remember that that's giving us in grams as opposed to kilograms. Yeah, so that's from the periodic table. So you can look it up on the periodic table. I think there's one in our book. But we all know where helium is, right, on the periodic table. Yep, yeah, yep. 2 neutrons, 2 protons, gram molecular weight of 4. So I guess I wouldn't expect you to know that for an exam, but you should be able to find it on a periodic table. You all are used to doing that sort of thing, right? Okay, so we got 7 liters, 3.5 moles of ideal gas. They tell us the pressure. Find the temperature. So it's just a different rearrangement of PV equals NRT. So we have PV divided by NR is going to be the temperature. We can find the average kinetic energy of the molecules in a gas by doing exactly this same game. What additional information do we need to find the speed of the molecule? Now, let's work it in pieces. So we've got a pressure, basically 16 atmospheres. Got a volume. Remember, we've got to convert that to cubic meters if we're going to use our usual units. 1,000 liters in a cubic meter, so this is 0.007. And they tell us we've got 3.5 moles, and the gas constant is 8.31. So we've got 1.6 NR exponent 6, 0.007 times that, 3.5 divided by it, and 8.31 dividing that. And I get 385, of course, Kelvin. Okay, so a little bit above the boiling point of water. What's the average kinetic energy? Well, the kinetic energy is 3/2 the Boltzmann constant times temperature. And you can look up the Boltzmann constant. I don't know if I would put it on my cheat sheet or not. I would probably tell you it. I can tell you that it's 1.38 times 10 to the minus 23. And we've got that 385 for our temperature. And we're going to get a very small number that is basically 8 times 10 to the minus 21 joules. Yes?
Why is it negative in the top equation?
This one here?
No, the top equation.
That's a leftover. More questions. So if we want to go between kinetic energy and speed, we need the mass, right? Because the kinetic energy is 1/2 mv². So if you tell me the mass of this thing, I can tell you the speed. The smaller the mass, the bigger the speed. So helium is moving faster than oxygen if it's at the same temperature. Okay. So let's go back to this sort of question that we had last time. So we've learned that temperature is roughly proportional to the kinetic energy that we have in ideal gas. Now, an ideal gas only can have kinetic energy because we're assuming that these are point particles that are bouncing around and not interacting with each other. If we think about something that's more complicated, it could have potential energy, say the potential energy of springs that are sometimes stretched and sometimes not stretched if we're thinking about a solid. So if we think about the total energy, I'll call it internal energy, to distinguish it from the bulk kinetic energy, right? So we might have a car that's moving at 50 miles an hour. It has some bulk kinetic energy, but in addition to that, its atoms are vibrating around. So there's internal kinetic energy that isn't particularly visible. What's the relationship between the total internal energy and the temperature? And if we were to make a plot of the total internal energy, it's usually denoted by U versus temperature. Generally speaking, it's increasing. But typically, it's not exactly a linear relationship. It's only an approximately linear relationship. So pretty commonly, it would kind of look like that. So this word heat is somewhat ambiguous. It might refer to the total internal energy. There's a very similar sounding quantity that your chemistry classes should have told you about, according to the MCAT people, and that's entropy, enthalpy. Did they? Enthalpy? Not yet? Yes, okay, good. So enthalpy and total internal energy are pretty closely related. They're not exactly the same thing. Pretty much when we're going to talking about heat now, we're going to be talking about changes in internal energy or changes in enthalpy. Now, there are another couple of symbols that I know the biologists at least have been introduced to, right? G, Gibbs free energy. The famous dead physicist Gibbs, who was one of the first American physicists of international reputation. Gibbs free energy. Good. What's the difference between Gibbs free energy and the enthalpy? Well, that has to do with the entropy, which is usually denoted by S. I think I heard that. Well, we're not there. We're not to these sorts of things quite yet. We're going to be start thinking about the internal energy and the enthalpy, the kind of heat content that we have of materials. And I hope it's clear that all of these things, except temperature, are extensive quantities, that if you have more, you have more, right? If you have twice as much water, you have twice as much total internal energy in that water. And what we're going to be concerned with pretty commonly are changes in the internal energy. So if we change the temperature by a certain amount, there's going to be a corresponding change in the internal energy or the enthalpy, take your pick. And what that depends on, of course, is the slope. What is the change in internal energy? I hope it's clear that that's going to be proportional to the mass or the number of moles times the change in temperature times something that's related to this slope. And that's called the specific heat. This word specific is usually denoting something that is an intensive quantity, so that it's either per gram or per cubic centimeter or per mole. In this case, because I factored out my mass as the extensive variable, this is going to be a heat per gram. So if we take a look at what the units are going to be of specific heat, internal energies are, of course, measured in joules. So the specific heat better have joules in the denominator, better have kilograms to cancel this kilograms, and say degrees Celsius or degrees Kelvin, same thing, change in temperature, in the denominator. So we've said that we're going to call changes in internal energy heat, and it's very commonly going to be used with the symbol Q. Okay, so the specific heat isn't exactly a constant. If we go to low temperatures, the slope is going to be less and the specific heat is going to be less. But we can tabulate the specific heat. It usually doesn't change a whole lot around room temperature, but we can tabulate the specific heat at lots of different temperatures. In this class, we're pretty much always going to be measuring energy in joules, but I don't know in your other classes if you measured things in calories. Joules all the time? That would be good. No comment. So there's a simple relationship between calories and joules, right? One calorie is 4.184 joules. Calorie is kind of an old unit of measuring energy before people figured out, in particular, Joule figured out. James Joule figured out the relationship that basically all of these things were the same thing, so there was no reason to have a different unit for heat than any other sort of energy. Okay, so if we start with a cold piece of ice at, say, near absolute zero, and we plot the internal energy versus temperature, as we increase the temperature, the internal energy gets more and more and more and more. When we reach a temperature that is about 273, what happens is that the temperature doesn't change, but there's a big change in internal energy as the ice goes to liquid water. So this change in internal energy that is occurring corresponding to a phase change, right? So what's changing here is we're going from ice to liquid, solid to liquid, I guess I should say, takes a certain amount of energy. So this is called, for kind of old-fashioned terminology, a latent heat. And it's, of course, an extensive quantity, right? More water is going to require more joules in order to heat it. Once we've got liquid water, we kind of continue with this upward trend with more or less a constant slope until we reach another phase change. Now we'll just continue it more or less on the same board. So here it is increasing. We reach a point where we have to boil the water. That all happens at pretty much the same temperature, namely 373. And the energy it takes to boil water is another latent heat. Once we've got gaseous water, water vapor, we're off with a more or less linear relationship between temperature and internal energy. Now these slopes are all slightly different. So it turns out that the slope that we have for water corresponds to about 4.18 joules per gram degree. Shouldn't actually have degrees Kelvin. And here the slope for ice is a little bit less. The specific ice for less is a little bit less. So here is a table of a bunch of specific heats. So here we have, so C is the usual relationship. The sub P is saying that kind of as normal, we're measuring these specific heats at constant pressure. So here we have joules per gram per Kelvin, and you see all sorts of different numbers, right? So hydrogen suddenly has a really different specific heat than, say, cesium. If you look at this side, there's not so much deviation. So here we're measuring the specific heat in joules per mole per K. There still are some exceptions like beryllium and boron and carbon. Where's carbon? But go down this list, well, there's some high exceptions too. If you go down this list, pretty much 25, 26 for the vast majority of materials. Okay, and there's something that I hope is immediately obviously special about boron and beryllium and carbon, right? They're relatively low mass elements. So this fact that the specific heat, not expressed in joules or calories per gram degree, but instead expressed in terms of joules or calories per mole degree, is roughly a constant. So that's the famous dead physicists Dulong and Petit, who are among the 72 scientists who have their names engraved at the base of the Eiffel Tower. Right, lots of famous dead French scientists, including Dulong and Petit. Okay, so specific heats are, if we do them per mole, there's a lot more commonality, but in any case, these are quantities that you would look up in something like the CRC, along with things like the latent heats of fusion, which is the joules per gram that it takes to melt something, or the latent heat of vaporization, which is the joules per gram that it would take to boil something. Okay. So, you know, for famous dead physicists, as far as we've gotten is having your name engraved at the base of the Eiffel Tower. When are we going to get to some Nobel Prize-winning physicists? So we started with Newton, right? So it's a long way back. Nobel Prizes started in 1900. In the next class, in 106, we're going to go through a slew of Nobel Prize-winning physicists, all dead. I think that's true. I don't think there are any living physicists have named pieces in 106. But we do come close to, in this class, to a famous dead physicist who won a Nobel Prize, and that's van der Waals. So, this is the ideal gas equation, and, you know, this is for ideal gases. Are any gases ideal? Well, no. Helium comes pretty close, but other gases are less than perfectly ideal. So, van der Waals produced a famous, more accurate equation that applies better to real gases. So, what van der Waals realized is that the volume that those guys could bounce around in isn't the volume of the container, because the atoms themselves have some size. So we need to not include the volume, we need to reduce the volume, taking into account the finite size of the atoms or molecules that are bouncing around in there. Also, if we think about exactly what's happening at the wall, so we have all of these molecules that are about to hit the wall. They are going to feel a force, attractive force between each other, which is called van der Waals force. And as a result, they're going to be slowed before they hit the wall. So the pressure is going to be a little bit less than what it might be. So if we want a better version of the ideal gas law, and in particular one that is accurate at higher pressures, we can go to this better version of the ideal gas law, for which you get a Nobel Prize in something like 1906. Now, there's something that's a little bit wrong with this explanation, and that is the idea that atoms have size. So Newton would have been quite happy to think about atoms having size. He thought of atoms as being little massy points, little spheres that had some sort of forces that led to them sticking together to make interesting chemistry, which is not too far from the truth. But anyone who tells you that atoms have a physical size or a surface kind of doesn't understand what's going on. So you could take a mathematical line and poke it through any piece of material you want to mention, and it would not hit anything. There's nothing really there. So, I don't know, as a maybe proof of that, if you think about the typical sort of grade school atom with electrons orbiting around the nucleus, and you had a little box, where would you position the box to be most likely to capture an electron? So where is the electron most likely to be? And the answer is right on top of the nucleus. Electrons happily go spinning right through the nucleus all the time. It's the single most likely place for the hydrogen atom electron to be. So if the nucleus, which is the massiest piece of an atom, is basically not there, it's just a bag of quarks, is there anything like the surface of a molecule. And there's not, right? Atoms really don't have size, really don't have surfaces. If people tell you contrary to that, they don't understand how atoms actually work. Okay, questions? So on to more problems. So what we've just been talking about, I would call calorimetry. And our main equation is going to be Q equals mc delta T, right? The specific heat, the mass, the change in temperature. So we'll go on and work lots of these sorts of problems on Tuesday? No, on Monday. And then Wednesday is when we'll have our first quiz for a while. And it'll be a calorimetry quiz, a Q equals mc delta T sort of quiz. Okay, well, let's quit.